Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm president of Tech Talk Studio and vice chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Conscious Capitalism Part 3. This is the Part 3 in a series we've been doing the last year and a half. We have our four panelists that will be discussing conscious capitalism. I'm going to be introducing each of the panelists individually and then asking them a question, and after that we'll be having a dialogue between the panelists and myself. At about 40 minutes into the program, we'll be taking audience questions, and then at about an hour and 10 minutes, we'll wrap up the program. So our first panelist for tonight is Rajan Dave, who's president of Hot Studio. Rajan is responsible for developing new business relationships and sponsoring core client engagements for Hot Studio. In addition to cultivating new relationships with startups and community organizations, Rajan has played an active role in developing partnerships with Cisco, eBay, Ancestry.com, Warner Music Group, and Dow Jones MarketWatch. He's also responsible for Hot Studio's operating strategy and the client-facing disciplines of business strategy, project management, and design engineering. Prior to joining Hot Studio, Rajan was the general manager of the San Francisco office of Modem Media Digitas for nearly 6 years, delivering interactive marketing strategy and solutions. Earlier in his career, Rajan was a technology strategist for a division of News Corporation and served as principal for the strategic consulting firm NextEra. Rajan holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science from UC Berkeley and an MBA from Columbia University, where he focused on finance and marketing. Well, Rajan, you were on our very first panel here a year and a half ago. I'm glad you could be back tonight. Now, can you tell us a little? Your company, Hot Studio, is a people-centered design firm, and you do a lot of work with helping organizations that are socially conscious. Can you tell us about how that works for you and what conscious capitalism means for Hot Studio, both facing outward and within your organization?
Perfect. Thanks, Kevin. It's really a pleasure to be here with all of you this evening. Thank you for taking the time out. I first of all have to say that going to work every day at Hot Studio is the best job I've ever had in my working life. And part of it, and we'll get into this over the topic tonight, is consciousness. And what I love about working at Hot Studio, which is a 40-person strategic design firm, is that we are able to actually be conscious about our activities and actions. And Maria Jadis, the CEO and founder of Hot Studio, is actually here tonight, so you can also talk to her later on as well. But part of what we've done, and she really set the tone for it, is to make sure that consciousness in terms of our actions and our work was a core value and part of our mission. And what that means for us is that even though we're working for Fortune 500, Global 500 firms all the time, we're also working with community organizations, probably 20 to 25% of our work, and startup firms for the other 20 to 25% of our work. What working with community organizations means for us is that we're working with groups like Architecture for Humanity, a recipient of the TED Prize a couple of years ago, Dave Eggers' Once Upon a School, also a recipient of the TED Prize last year. We get to work with SF MoMA. We work with the California Academy of Science, as we'll be talking a little bit more about tonight. And all of it is really based upon our core methodology. And the core methodology, being people-centered, is really starting with an understanding of what an audience might need. So for the California Academy of Science, it's everything from children, their parents, other visitors coming in from out of state, teachers, researchers, and then anybody else who might need to know about the facility. On the other side is really the stakeholders in terms of what are they trying to do from an organizational or a business perspective, and then really working to define a space whereby we can solve problems. And for us, it's primarily in the interactive space, so the the website for the California Academy, and then thinking about how mobile interactions also work with that. But the net for us is by having this kind of work be part of our social fabric in the office is that it provides a value proposition to our employees. So we have a very low employee turnover rate, and the last 5 years, we've lost very few employees, and it's because folks want to be at a place that has this type of value as a core tenant. And so not only are we able to really start to think about triple bottom line in terms of global perspectives from the institutions that we help and affect, but also from an internal perspective in terms of our people, our radiation out to the planet in terms of the work we do, and then ultimately how we think about profit and the allocation of that towards those types of goals.
Thank you, Rajan. Our second panelist is Kat Taylor. Kat is the co-founder of One California Bank. Kat Taylor is active in a variety of public benefit and philanthropic ventures in the San Francisco Bay Area. Currently, she focuses on banking services and food systems through two primary organizations. Kat and her husband, Tom Steyer, are the founding directors of One California Bank and Foundation, a triple bottom line federal savings bank in Oakland, California, attempting to help low-income individuals, households, and communities build and protect assets through fair and innovative banking products and services with hopes of expanding throughout California. Kat is also a founding director of Tomcat Ranch Educational Foundation, dedicated to a return to sustainable food production through ranching, tours, study, and school lunch and garden programs. Related to that work, Kat's a partner in INCA, I-N-K-A, INCA, a startup company pioneering closed-loop food growing solutions that use very little water, soil, or other scarce resources, and no harmful chemical agents for home, educational, and developing world settings. Since 1986, Kat has served as a member of the board of directors of the Good Samaritan Family Resource Center, the Insight Prison Project, and past board member of KQED and Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Kat graduated from Harvard College in 1980 with a BA degree. She earned a joint JD-MBA degree from the Stanford Law School and the Stanford Graduate School of Business, graduating in 1986. So we have a lot of MBAs here tonight, and we have some really hard-line business experience, too. So, Kat, I'm really interested to know, what is a triple bottom-line bank, and are you responsible for what happened?
Yeah, you're probably thinking, like, why do they have a banker on this panel? I'm really appreciative of the chance to talk about One California Bank and Foundation because we like to open source this idea. We are a model in progress. We are trying to prove out the concept in Oakland, California, and hoping if it works to expand throughout California. But we're really happy. We've learned a lot from pioneering socially responsible financial institutions before us. We're colleagues with them now, including New Resource Bank right down the street. And we invite comment and input from all communities about how to get this done. Essentially, we are a triple bottom line bank because we need to achieve financial sustainability so that we can percolate along like a perpetual motion machine at the same time that we produce measurable social outcomes and environmental benefits. We take a systems approach to banking. And we hope that banks will from now on, too. But essentially that it's our responsibility to keep the banking ecosystem healthy. That's what allows banking to continue and to provide goods and services to customers that they value and that enhance their future economic opportunity and prosperity. We are focused on low-income communities in an effort to make sure that low-income economies receive the credit they need to develop small business, mainstream business, generate jobs that come from growth in those business sectors, and increase the asset development of individuals, families, households in those communities. As a commercial bank, our focus is on lending to businesses. That's where we believe the economic engine is. But we also pay a lot of attention to nonprofits and community facilities. We can help them through their banking needs become more efficient, attain better survivability, and continue to provide the essential services that all local communities need. We also have a very targeted retail product strategy. We feel that if we're going to help individuals, households, and communities build their assets, we need to take a stake in protecting them as well. And sometimes it's easy for new-fought gains to dribble out through predatory financial practices, some of which you may have heard of lately in the news would be payday lending, high-fee check cashing, and churning transactional costs in a conventional banking account. So we are developing a suite of retail products to provide competitive alternatives to all the needs that send a person, a household, or a business to those services in the first place. So people do have needs for emergency, one-time, responsible, low-dollar loans, and we'd like to be a participant in providing those using the highest technology platforms possible, a customer relationship approach, and responsibly amortized financial products. We have a very unusual ownership structure that gives us incredibly good mission congruence with individuals, low-income communities, and nonprofits. We are owned by our foundation. When the bank was capitalized, in the same instant, two classes of stock were created, and all the economic stock was given to a foundation of the same name. This is highly unusual in the banking environment. There are a lot of bank foundations, but they don't own their banks. And it allows our bank foundation to do anything it wants to enhance the productivity and outcome of the bank, because at the end of the day, any profit of the bank rolls back up into a nonprofit foundation who's dedicated to community goals in the realm of anti-poverty, community health, public safety, those sorts of broad community benefits. So we invite everybody to come take a look at our website, come visit us, and we'd love to hear back from people about what they think of this new financial innovation in the banking sector.
So what is your website?
It's www.onecalbank.com.
Okay, thank you. Well, our next panelist is Don Schio from the California Academy of Sciences. Don, just only last week was given a very nice new job. He is now Chief Operating Officer for California Academy of Sciences. His previous position was Chief Revenue Officer. I don't have a brand new bio for him, so I'm going to give you the Chief Revenue Officer bio. Maybe he can tell us a little bit more about his new position, but I'll just read the bio that I do have here. As the Chief Revenue Officer at the California Academy of Sciences, Don Schio oversees revenue generation for the Academy's sales channels, retail stores, restaurant locations, group event rentals, concession arrangements, and other strategic partnerships. Additionally, he is responsible for ensuring that visitors to the museum have an all-around positive experience. Schio previously worked for Universal Studios Hollywood, where he was Senior Vice President of Marketing and Sales. Prior to that, Schio worked in senior marketing roles for Pepsi, Baskin-Robbins, and Teleflora. Prior to joining the Academy in 2007, Don volunteered his time at a nonprofit organization, Levitt & Quinn Family Law Center in Los Angeles, a firm that provides quality, low-cost legal services to persons living at low to moderate income levels to help them resolve family conflicts. Schio graduated with honors from Brown University with a degree in economics and organizational behavior and management, and earned an MBA at the Anderson School of Management at UCLA. So, Don, you've had quite a career, from Teleflora and Dunkin' Donuts to Universal Studios to the California Academy of Sciences. And you've told me before about how they created a brand new job for you as Chief Revenue Officer. I've never heard of a museum or a cultural institute having a Chief Revenue Officer. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works and what the conscious capitalism approach means for you and sustainable business at the Academy?
I can, and I had never heard of a Chief Revenue Officer myself when I came up to San Francisco. First, Kevin, I want to say thank you for having me as a panelist, and I thank you all for coming as well. How many of you have been to the California Academy of Sciences, if I can just see by a show of hands? I want to tell you just a quick personal story that you may or may not find interesting, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about what conscious capitalism means at the Academy. About 2 years ago, I was invited to come up to San Francisco and see the California Academy of Sciences, which was under construction. And I have to be quite honest, I had never heard of the California Academy of Sciences. And I said at the time, I don't know that I'd be necessarily interested. And they said, well, listen, we'll bring you up for a 4-day week into San Francisco. Well, how can you resist that? So I said, okay, fine. I'm I'm headed up. Well, the first thing they did is they took me on a tour of the building about a year before it opened. So the building was pretty much completed. We just didn't have the living collection in yet and a lot of the exhibits. And I realized that my palms were starting to sweat because after about an hour to an hour and a half, I realized I really want this job. And I came up just for a four-day weekend just to have fun. Things actually came together. And about 2 years ago this coming August, I moved to San Francisco, and it was the best decision of my life. I will actually challenge Raj of having the best job that I've ever had. The mission of the Academy is to explore, explain, and to protect the natural world. And we opened last September, as many of you are probably aware. And at this point, we've admitted almost 1.8 million visitors so far. So if you haven't, if you didn't raise your hand and you haven't visited, it's starting to actually, we're getting through the opening hump. From a conscious capitalism standpoint, my role as a chief revenue officer was to make sure that we were doing things that were consistent with our mission. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One of those would be from a retail standpoint. So we were very conscientious about what products that we were bringing in. One of the things that I always say is it's not necessarily that we are able to make the best choices, but we're trying to make better choices from an economic standpoint, but also from an environmental standpoint. Another example, we were approached as we were looking at corporate partnerships, we had a bottled water company approach us, and they said, we're willing to give you a seven-figure partnership fee, sponsorship fee. And we said, we can't accept that. That's just not who we are. It's not part of our mission. We have this area in the middle of the Pacific, this cloud the size of Texas that is full of just broken plastic bottles, and you cannot find a water bottle in our facility unless someone's brought one in. So that would be another example. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that we're being true to our mission. We're trying to make sure that we are increasing science literacy, which has been on a decline for decades now. We're also trying to make sure that we are not necessarily proselytizing, but we're serving as advocates. So we're answering really two key questions. One is, where did we come from? How did we evolve? And how do we get here today? And the other key question is, how do we sustain life and how do we actually stay here in the future? One of the other things that I might point out is that as people are coming through, there are a myriad of questions. And I found over the last 18 months, I'm even changing my behaviors. The first couple of months that I was on board, I had to actually send a fax. And I walked across two floors, three floors, trying to find a fax machine. And I realized we only use e-fax. So we're even modulating our behavior as we learn about it, or I am modulating my behavior. So anyways, it's a pleasure to be here. I hope you have an opportunity to get out to the Academy and check it out yourselves.
Thank you. Our next panelist is Steve Panetti, Senior VP of Sales and Marketing at the Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants, formerly the Kimpton Group. They have a fairly new name, so if I call them the Kimpton Group, you have to excuse me. Steve Panetti, Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants, oversees all sales, marketing, advertising, public relations, CRM, and e-commerce activities for the hotel and restaurant management company Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants, based in San Francisco. Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants currently manages 44 boutique hotels and 45 fine dining chef-driven restaurants in the U.S. and Canada. Prior to joining Kimpton Hotels and Restaurants in 1982, Steve Panetti began his hospitality career with Hilton and Hyatt, where he held a number of positions in hotel sales and marketing. He was recognized as a top producer for both organizations. He helped develop corporate incentive travel programs as well as breakthrough industry software that provided the foundation for PMS systems today. Now, Steve, you've been around Kimpton for a long time, and I know you were actually the number two employee with Bill Kimpton, and I've heard the story you've told other places about you and Bill Kimpton being in one room with one phone and sharing that phone, and you've built an amazing organization since then. Now, really, one of the keys to your success is conscious capitalism through a number of programs that you guys have instituted. How's that working out for you today, and how has that been important for you building your brand, and how is that working in today's economy?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name's Steve, and I'm grateful to be here, and especially with the panelists. This is a great bunch. I can't wait to hear what all these folks here got to say tonight. I love my job, too. You know, it was really clear. We were very clear from the very beginning that one of the cornerstones of our company needed to really focus on participating in the fabric within which the communities where our businesses were located, where our employees, you know, went to school, where they raised their kids, where they bought their groceries. We started the company back, in San Francisco in 1981. Well, in 1981 in San Francisco, the AIDS epidemic was going pretty full-blown. And all of you who work wherever it is that you work, you probably have a pretty good sense of family with all the people that you work with. You have your daytime family, and you got your people at home. Well, in our daytime families back in those days in the five or six businesses that we had here in San Francisco, we would lose five or six people to HIV/AIDS every single year. So it brought us all pretty close together as a company. It brought us all pretty close together with our community. And it's been a cause that we have supported ever since, and it's a cause that we have supported in every city that we're in today. Additionally, back in those days, we recycled. We were kind of, you call it unconscious competence, or you call it because you grew up in California, but we recycled before people even really had it that well organized. And I can remember our first meetings with the Sunset Scavengers about recycling cans. It's like, that's fine. Well, we can pick up all those different colored cans, but where are we going to take all that stuff? We don't have any place to take it, and we don't really recycle. And so we were instrumental in kind of getting some of the trash recycle programs going here in the city. And in 1985, we saved a park on a roof of a building downtown, and we got labeled as environmentalists long before there was an actual bandwagon. And in 95, the Triton Hotel here in San Francisco, we worked with the California EPA, and we dedicated a floor to be called, quote, the Eco Floor, which met all of the California EPA standards, you know, recycled air, recycled water. You could eat the bedspread, you could eat the pillow, you could, you know, everything worked, everything was perfect. And we were the official green hotels in California back in 95. So we've been very active with our environmental program. And then the third organization that we were very involved with was the Dress for Success. I'm surrounded by all these alpha women down where I work, and so we needed to kind of hook up with a woman's organization, but we picked a really terrific one, Dress for Success. We've been with them now for 5 years. We're on their board. They have a chapter in every one of our cities. The five cities where they did not, we actually started chapters, like here in San Francisco, and we're responsible for putting about 500 women who have been down and out on their luck back up on their feet. Every year, they get trained, they get developed, they get clothed, they get interviewing skills. Many of them we've actually hired. So I know that with Kevin, you know, a lot of our claim to fame more recently has been around the environmental aspect because we chose about 5 years ago to actually take a higher road. In those days, everybody was writing big carbon offset checks. Everybody thought if you write a great big carbon offset check, you're doing your part to save the planet. But meanwhile, you're not changing all your behaviors that are kind of yucking up the place in the first place, right? So we don't like to write big checks because we're not that big. But we thought, you know, why don't we change our behavior? Why don't we maybe see what we can do to modify how we do what we do so we lessen our carbon impact? And as all of you know, it's easier to die than it is to change behavior, you know. So how many people still have, who even remembers their New Year's resolution? But anyway, but we took that road, and kind of part of why I'm sitting here today is because we actually did a really good job, and we've got over 85 different things that we do on a day-to-day basis in every one of our hotels and restaurants. And if you go to our website, kimptonhotels.com, and go to the Earth Care or Eco section, you can see all the cool things that we're doing on a daily basis. There's some easy stuff like, you know, recycled paper and using soy ink throughout the whole company, to the cleaning supplies, to the coffee, to the water. There's a lot of stuff going on. So I'm very fortunate. I grew up here in San Francisco, ran into Bill Kempton at a time when he was just getting going. You know, this has been an awesome ride. USA Today came out with an article about a year ago identifying the top 25 most pivotal influences in the hotel industry in the last 25 years.
And we were number six, right behind online bookings and right in front of roller luggage, which I always thought was, I thought was really cool. So, you know, we use our recognition, of which we get a lot, to try to influence. You know, we're just one little drop in the bucket, and we get that. But through our ability to influence our employees, our guests, our investors, our vendors, we're able to make an impact. And it's a very employee action-oriented company. The Indians run the place, and they do a great, great job. Corporate's job is to block and tackle and come up with the money and make sure we clear the way so that our employees can kind of help live their social dreams and enact their social consciousness through our tools, which are our businesses. So,
that's great. Thank you, Steve. Well, I have there's a general question that was in our stated objectives for tonight. I'm going to start with Rajan. But if the other panelists would like to answer this question or jump in, or if you have, at any point, if you have comments on each other's shares, we're going to open this up now. And be thinking in the audience, if you have any questions for the panel members here, start writing them down on the audience question cards, and somebody will be going around to pick those up. So, Rajan, what are the roles of sustainability, philanthropy, business, and community partnerships in creating a new paradigm of prosperity? And I know for you guys at Hot Studio, you do a lot of really amazing community partnerships, things that you have done through the TED Prize, things you've done on your own. I'm very interested in hearing about Architecture for Humanity and the Open Architecture Network, the work you're doing recently with Dave Eggers, Once Upon a School, the Omidyar Network. I mean, we could go on and on. But can you give us some idea? What's the Hot Studio approach to partnerships?
Yeah, well, I think the key thing with partnerships is really it's about developing an ecosystem. And in all of those cases, it's amazing where you develop these partnerships with not only the exact organization that you think that you're going to be working with, but then it starts getting deeper. So, for instance, with the Architecture for Humanity partnership, it really started with this coordinated partnership that was brought together by the folks at TED along with Sun Microsystems and us and, of course, Cameron Sinclair and his organization. And what it really got to was, okay, how are we going to start to solve some problems? So in terms of solving for Architecture for Humanity, one of the key things that happened was some very basic ethnography, which was, well, how is this environment, openarchitecture.org, going to be used? And Maria and Katrina got on planes and went to Biloxi, Mississippi shortly after Katrina, which was going to be a core sort of scenario for how these tools were going to be used. And suddenly, they were now part of some new communities, which were communities in crisis, communities of people who were organizing around solving for that crisis, and then all of these other folks that we knew we were going to be partnering with in terms of building this environment where we could solve these problems not only locally but globally. So it's really amazing what happens once you start to get involved, and I think the same happened with working on Dave Eggers' Once Upon a School, where we really started, you know, being put together with him and his organization after Maria was so excited about hearing about his TED Prize wish. And then that led us into really understanding what that organization is about and 826 Valencia, and then really meeting people on the ground who are out there doing things and thinking about, okay, how do we help them tell their stories and be involved and do even more? So it starts with really that first word of being conscious, getting involved, and being open to partnerships, because partnerships are hard. So one of the things for us is, you know, even though the whole idea of sustainability and really being conscious in terms of what we're doing is part of our core value set, that whole idea of being great collaborators is really core to how we operate. And I think that's been really one of the things in our DNA which has helped us make these partnerships work. You know, ultimately, it's in those partnerships where you learn really what you need to do. I mean, at the beginning, it's you have a vague notion of where you're going, but then it's when you're really working with people at a very detailed level is where you find the true insights that lead to the greatest answers. Yep.
And Rajan, how do these partnerships help with your triple bottom line, with your employees and your profit? And
yeah, well, so there are a couple different things, and so some of these partnerships are with very large corporations like Gap and rolling out the Red brand, and you know, and maybe another question we can talk a little bit about that in terms of programmatically what that means. But certainly what these partnerships mean is that we create this environment where our employees are able to participate in things that they wouldn't necessarily be able to easily participate in as individuals. And certainly many of our competitors do not take the time or invest either the profit or their other, you know, intellectual property in terms of getting involved with them. So it really creates an environment where our employees are very excited about participating. What's interesting, and I think one of the themes that Steve was talking about as we were coming in, and we should also weave into this, is, you know, we're in a very difficult economic environment. So what does that mean for us? And I think what's been great for us is we've seen some of these partnerships have then helped us broaden our reach into communities and into relationships, which have really been sustaining even in this difficult economic time where a lot of work that is foundation funded continues. And because of that, you know, we have a very broad portfolio for a small company. And, you know, what that means is maybe in tougher economic times, it's really using those dollars in very, very smart ways. But we're exposed to an even broader set of work than we might have been in the community and organization space because of our focus on that earlier on.
That's great. Well, Don, thank you, Rajan. Don, I'm going to go over to you now and talk about community partnerships. Now, certainly the Academy is partnering with the community, but also you've got a whole range of partnerships from your donor base and your board to all your – you have a huge volunteer staff. You're involved in ecotourism. Can you tell us what this means for you guys at the Academy?
Yeah, I think that partnerships cross over so many different channels, and I'll try to speak to a couple of them here. One would be from really the donor member base that we have, and they have been extremely generous to us. But I point out to people that before we closed the facility in 2003, I moved in the temporary facility in Howard Street. From the when you look at the operating expenses of the facility back then to when we reopened, the expenses are more than 2.5 times higher than the former facility. Part of that is driven by the fact that we have 38,000 living animals that we have to take care of. And I tell people that if I was to associate myself with another cultural institution, I might pick a art museum because because art doesn't eat. And we have to feed the fish and all the variety of animals that we have. We have 21 staff biologists, and they spend 50% of their time just feeding all these animals. But we are shifting, and when they talk about a chief revenue officer position, I've now seen actually in a couple of – I Google it every now and then just to see where are these other chief revenue officers. It's because within the nonprofit arena, the word sales was a bad word. And I always tell people that I work for a nonprofit, but that doesn't mean no profit. And so my goal is to generate as much revenue as we can so we continue to expand the programs, whether that is some 200 staff researchers that we have that are all over the world. We have field programs in Madagascar, Costa Rica. This week they just left for Costa Rica. We have teams in the Philippines. They're essentially all over the world. Or if it's to fund more educational programs because we're trying to increase science literacy, or if it means that we are trying to bring in more fourth and fifth graders because that's a critical age. And we have a wonderful donor who has actually given us a grant so that all fourth and fifth graders in the San Francisco Unified School District can come in for free. And free means we pay for your bus, we pay for your lunch, we pay for your T-shirt. If you come back in your T-shirt, you come back in again free because we're trying to engage fourth and fifth graders at that critical period so that they'll want to actually get into a career in science. Another example of partnerships would be if I looked within the tourism arena. So we work very closely with the San Francisco Convention and Visitors Bureau. We work very closely with the California Travel and Tourism Commission. And the reason why we're doing that is in this very, very tough economy that we're in, everybody has limited resources. So what we need to do is we need to essentially come up with cooperative programs where we're pooling our resources and trying to convince people to come not just to California but to San Francisco. Having been here for not quite 2 years, I look at the old Academy as this wonderful cultural institution, but it was essentially a museum on the west side of town. What we're trying to do now is we're trying to actually turn the tide, and we're actually trying to create this new global icon. We'd like to be 5-10 years from now viewed as the Smithsonian of the West Coast. And it takes resources to do that. So the partnerships cross over lots of different channels.
Thank you. Well, Steve, you guys are definitely a for-profit organization.
Oh, yes, we are.
But but you do an awful lot of stuff that it seems like nonprofits and partnerships with nonprofits. You mentioned some of the things you already do. Now, let me ask you the hard question. Is this a marketing gimmick that you guys do? I mean, is this something that you do so you can rake in the green bucks, or does this come out of your corporate culture?
I wish it was a marketing gimmick, because then business would maybe be a little bit better than it is right now. So there was a whole bunch of questions there. It started the way it should have, from the heart, in that we're a company that totally believes if you give the love, you will get the love. You know, it's kind of if you build it, they will come, if you're doing the right thing. And all of our programs have been kind of predicated on that premise. The environmental really was something that was it was going on randomly around our company, and more and more we were getting call from our employees. Our employees wanted more of a organized program around what can we do. You know, we want to go plant trees on Earth Day, or we want to, you know, get rid of all the bottles in the hotel, or we want to do whatever. How come we're using lead-based paint? You know, we want to get something going with our organization. So it really started more from the employees wanting the fact that they belong to a company that was decentralized. It gives the employees a very free rein to call anybody in the organization and say, I got a great idea. I think we ought to do this, and we got a lot of smart people, and there were a lot of really great ideas. So we formed the Earth Care Committee nationwide, which basically meant we had 2 Earth Care champions in every hotel and every restaurant. We asked for volunteers to organize this thing, and we weren't looking for the general manager or the chef. We wanted the person who was the most passionate around sustainability. So you might end up with a hostess from the restaurant, or the bellman from the hotel, or the lady who's the room cleaner, or whatever it might be. And we started meeting about, well, what are the things that we could do? What are the things that we could do internally to have a very, very positive impact? The end game, though, was pretty awesome. At the end of it all, you know, 5 years later, because we chose to change behavior, you know, changing your recycling habits can save one of my hotels and restaurants $8,000-$9,000 a month. Putting in water shower restrictors that you can adjust so you don't get a real benign shower can save a hotel $3,000-$4,000 a month, and on and on and on. The employees, I've got some of the lowest turnover in the industry. The number 2 reason people come to work for us and stay with us is because of the environmental program, period. They fill out a blank. We don't give them prompts. 16% of the customers who come to us for the very first time in our hotels do so specifically because of our environmental program. And right now, if you look out in our industry, which is getting creamed right now, our hotels in all of our cities are doing better than our competitive hotels. So for a program that did not start out with a marketing motivation, it's a marketing dream come true. It saves me money. It keeps my employees happy. It brings in new first-time customers. I'm doing what I ought to be doing if I care about saving the planet. It's one of those few opportunities that comes your way where everybody completely wins. And the really big, the kind of the cool thing, because, you know, once in a while you like to just, you kind of like to, like, whack somebody once in a while. These companies, we went to the biggest chemical supplier of cleaning supplies in our industry, who we did business with a few years back, and said, we need organic products. We're going green. And they're like, no, we're not doing green. We don't do that. You know, it's like, well, you know what? You just lost our national account. You know, 40 restaurants, 40 hotels. It's a big deal. And we went out and pieced together six regional people to provide that product. So what I like is that it wins on every level, and it actually does allow us to have an impact on other businesses that we do business with. And at the end of the day, it's helped sustain our business during this most difficult of times so that we can continue to do the things that we do enjoy doing, which is giving back where we can. So it's been a real big win for us all the way around.
Thanks. So, Kat, now, along with these community partnerships, one of the issues that I want to ask all the panelists about is the whole idea of education. And when we were having our talks before we got here tonight, I've been talking with each of the panelists, and we had an hour beforehand to talk about this. Across the board, there's an issue of education. Each one of you guys is involved in some kind of education and outreach work. Now, for you, I know a really important part of your community partnerships are, in fact, promoting financial literacy. Now, how does that all work for you guys? Is that key to your mission?
It is, and I hope you'll indulge me. I just want to say something about the
sure.
last line
please,
of questioning,
go ahead.
And I'll
yeah.
knit it back to what you...
That's take as much time as you want.
So anything I say is really a promise to proceed as opposed to results in the bag, because we're a two-year-old bank, so we're still finding our way. I told these guys I'm taking a lot of notes tonight. But I think in our approach to banking, we are in some respects rejecting competition and in some respects embracing it, and all of that in a collaborative way. And what I mean by that is, if competition means sort of a blind, unified march in mimicry toward disastrous outcomes, which I think we've all witnessed recently in the banking sector, then we'll have no part of that. If our incentives aren't set up in a way that leave us rooting for our customers as opposed to rooting against them, then there's something wrong in our model. That's called what I think of as sort of cannibalizing your customer base. So the parts of competition that we absolutely embrace are the discipline parts of it, that we absolutely must plan, we must measure, we must innovate, we must pay attention to what's actually happening. And our solution set has to be broad and deep, but it has to be in concert with our culture, which I think is a lot of what Steve was just talking about. And he said very eloquently in our pre-conversations that you're going to find the answer, but you're not going to unravel your culture to do it. One of the things we pay a lot of attention to is that we don't operate in a silo. We operate in a community that has a lot of socioeconomic phenomenon. Now, we can't be so grandiose as to think that we can solve all the problems. But when you are working in a community like Oakland, which is a community of enormous potential, you have to pay attention to the broader socioeconomic forces around you and find the role you can play in those solutions, because they will overwhelm you if you don't. So it will do us little good to be an excellent bank in a terrible neighborhood. We need to be part of a great neighborhood, and we need to do our part to do that. Since I have just an academic MBA, not the real MBA of, you know, seasoned experience in a sector. In any event, I think about it in terms of public goods and externalities. So we work really hard to minimize externalities in our communities, and we work really hard to help increase the supply of public goods. And one of those most essential public goods is education, and specifically the one aspect of education that we not only can but should address is financial education. So we couple all of our products with financial education. We also design our products in a way that you can start with an entry-level bank account that reduces to nearly zero the possibility, for instance, that you're going to overdraft, because there's a certain practice to using your money that you need to come to before you have a chance to really harm your credit record or get yourself in a pickle financially. So we design a safe, it's called the OneCal safe account. It's an entry-level product where you can't overdraft. You can graduate from there to a bank account where you get notice if you are about to overdraft, opportunities to cure. We don't process checks in an order that maximizes overdrafts. That may be something that people in this room aren't even aware of, since I wasn't until I went to start a bank with a bunch of much smarter people and bankers. that there is the ability to maximize overdrafts in transactional accounts. We eschew that. We don't do that. And we let people know that that's one of the options. So financial education in our realm not only means that you might do a better job managing your own finances, it might make you a better consumer. And if you're a better consumer, you will demand different services from banks either. And you may not even bank with us. But if our salutary effect is that you ask a different set of questions of your banks of choice, then that's a very good outcome for us. So our foundation is able to offload a lot of the cost of providing financial education from the bank, so we can stick to the discipline of business, of running a bank that is financially sustainable, and ask the foundation to subsidize public goods like education. We also couple our loan products with education. So that's probably longer than you wanted to hear.
No, that's just fine. Thank you. Now, Rajan, one of the things that you guys do at Hot Studio is a lot of research. That's why you're people-centered design, and you have extensive research that you guys do for your commercial clients. How do you use that to really make your nonprofit work accessible and the best kind of education possible for people?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, I think the key... I talked a little bit about how the research actually works, which is in terms of defining who the end users of something are going to be. And I think one of the key things that we've also found out is in how do we talk about the work that we've done externally in helping those clients that really need to create engagement in their environments. So, for instance, the Architecture for Humanity clients, how do we help them also get folks involved in their network and community as well? Now, the whole topic about education is core to us. One of the things that we did early on was we were early adopters of something called the Designers Accord. And as being adopters of the Designers Accord, what that meant for us is, one, to basically declare that we were members, and then, two, to really focus on engaging with clients as we see opportunities to talk about things that are either about social responsible practices or other types of sustainable design practices. So as we were talking to Cal Academy about their new building, we didn't have to talk to them at all because they were telling us about their LEED certification and everything was really absolutely best practice. There are other situations where we see materials where we talk about some of those things. But then also there's a tenet around education. And so that education is both internal. Now, we have a relatively small firm, but we do have a sustainable practice team that is really focused on those types of issues. And then they also update the rest of the team on their work as well. So the education that we do becomes both external client focus as well as internal, our own employees and staff.
Can I add to that, Kevin?
Sure, go ahead.
From an education standpoint, from an academy standpoint, we could look at education from a very traditional standpoint, and that is just increasing science literacy. We can also look at it from the standpoint of our mission is also to protect the natural world, and we've been placed in a situation where with this LEED rating, people are asking a lot of questions about the architecture. And one of the things we're trying to do is, rather than looking at guests coming in the front doors, we're also now just starting in our FY10 planning process to talk about how does education expand beyond the four walls, the brick and mortar of the academy. How do we actually push it out, whether it's through our website, whether it's through mobile devices? But we're looking at education not just as the destination of coming to the academy, but beyond that as well and through technology.
Wow. And now, Steve, you had your...
I'm thinking of Kat's comments, and I know that the focus right now for the bank is in kind of secondary cities because, those are the folks that could use the help. But I think that your timing on your product is... I don't think it could be much better. I think, in the recent times, we've seen environmental and economic, just how fragile the world is that we live in. And I think people are... There's still some anger out there, and I think that there's a new accountability that we see in our focus groups with our employees where people want to take a little bit more into their own hands, accountability for where they spend their money, this whole idea of shared values. I want to spend my money in my world, in hotels or airlines or car rentals that share those same moral values, whether it's around the environment or helping the community or whatever it may be. But I think that your timing is great, and I think it's a product not just for a secondary city. I think it's something that would go downtown as well. And I think people are going to hold as best they can, you know, the businesses that they do business with, the people that they elect for government, the corporations that they buy products from. There's hopefully a growing sense of higher accountability and higher integrity. And I think we're kind of all speaking to it, but being the startup kind of, so to speak, what you represent are all the things that all of us are talking about. I think it's really cool. It would be interesting to see if you guys, you know, once you've done it where you are, you know, move it downtown. Because I think the same folks in the financial district have got the same problems, you know. Maybe more zeros, but the same problems.
So, Kat, do you guys take hotel organizations as clients too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good. I hope there'll be a commission for me in this when we get done with all this.
You'll always have a hotel room to stay in.
I like to stay at Kimpton. That would be good. Well, Don, let me ask you a question here. We're talking about the various kinds of ways to get people into the city, and so we're all four of you are really talking about ways to motivate people. One of the things that I'm really interested for when I've talked to you is your focus on ecotourism and really using California Academy of Sciences to create a San Francisco destination for ecotourism. So I'm interested for all the panelists, but how do we bring meaning into our sales efforts and ecotourism. I know there's certainly for my wife and I that's very appealing. But what does this mean in the larger sense for you and what you're doing?
Well, first, before I talk about the tourism aspect, first I'd like to just comment on more what I would call the locals, and the California Academy of Sciences was really built on the local residents. And what you may or may not know, that it started back in 1853, making it the third oldest museum in the country, behind the Smithsonian, that was only a couple years ahead of the Academy, and behind the Philadelphia Natural History Museum. So this has been in the San Franciscan residents' blood for a very, very long time, and we always want to show great appreciation for what they've done. They've actually passed bond measures to get things built for the Academy as well. Now, moving to tourism, we didn't really have a tourism department to speak of 18 months ago. And it's developed, again, through partnerships with the Convention and Visitors Bureau, as well as the California Travel and Tourism Commission, the United States Travel Association. And we are not, at this point, we don't have the kind of awareness to convince people to come to the Academy from Chicago, from London, from Tokyo. What we can do is when people come to San Francisco and they've heard about us or they've seen us in the press and make a visit, we can extend the length of stay in the city. That's really what our goal is to extend the length of stay. We don't have the resources to advertise all over the world. You have probably seen the banner advertising we've done. You've probably seen the radio advertising, but that is limited to San Francisco. So we've always talked within the tourism industry that we're trying to convince people to stay longer, and it has an economic benefit, whether that means they're staying in the Kimpton hotels longer, whether that means that they're eating at restaurants along Fisherman's Wharf. But our economic vitality is really driven by convincing people not to go to Las Vegas. Because they come in from Tokyo, they spend 2 days in San Francisco, and then they're off to Las Vegas. And we're trying to tell them, you're going to lose all your money anyways. Stay in San Francisco for 4 days. Tourism is something we're really, I think, at the tip of the iceberg. We expected to generate about, because it's long lead, it takes a good 12 to 18 months to get started in the tourism industry. We expected to have maybe 50,000 visitors come within this tourism channel. This year, I think we're going to be getting closer to about 175,000. So it's actually really taken off. And I give the credit to what I call poor man's media, and that's the press. We have given tour after tour after tour. This past Tuesday, the vice president of the Maldives came through, and it was so interesting to me. He and the second madam wanted to see the institution because they said, in 10 years, we want to make the Maldives the first carbon-neutral country. and they're doing it out of necessity. You may know that they are just 1 meter above sea level. So as global warming is occurring, their lives as they know it is literally and figuratively shrinking. In any event, tourism is really now starting to take off, and we want to continue with that just because of the economic vitality to the city.
Wow. Well, now, Steve, this is a slam dunk for you, so I'm going to come back to you in a minute. But Rajan, I wanted to hear a little bit more about the Open Architecture Network, because one of the things I'm interested in is how conscious capitalism embraces technology to bring together people from all over the world. And the Open Architecture Network brings designers and architects from all over the world to help people all over the world, right? And not necessarily anywhere near each other.
Yeah, so I think what you're getting at is then what do some of these solutions enable? So because we work primarily online, I think the thing is that these ideas that can be very local ideas can then be translated into global action. So with Architecture for Humanity and the Open Architecture Network, basically what you've got are literally thousands of design projects to solve post-disaster situations or refugee-type situations, but focus primarily on housing and buildings, where you have designers, architects primarily, collaborating from all around the world, providing their designs, having builders provide their expertise locally, and having this platform that's run by essentially a group of less than 8 people in San Francisco basically providing this service for people all over the world, and all doing it without shipping documents back and forth between each other, because those are all in the environment, and then providing a repository where that intellectual property can be reused elsewhere when there are other situations that might be able to use the same type of material. So, you know, I think one of the challenges and opportunities certainly in this in the environment that we're working in is, you know, you can take a local type issue and solve it globally and then replicate those solutions and really get a lot of value out of the work that's been done. So the question is then also, how does that kind of global thinking maybe translate into the other questions that we're asking here tonight too?
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to remind our radio audience right now, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Conscious Capitalism Part 3. Our panelists are Rajan Dave of Hot Studio, Kat Taylor of One California Bank, Don Skeel of the California Academy of Sciences, and Steve Panetti from Kimpton Hotels. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm Vice Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. And our program, again, is Conscious Capitalism Part 3. So, Kat, how does this affect what you guys are doing?
I think it would be a mistake to think of the banking sector as just one giant, uniform block of banks who all behave the same way. And so within our own industry, we have very good banking efforts over time at defining the value proposition of banking services. They've been good at doing it in the past, and I think there's going to be an evolution of that value proposition to include more nuanced considerations based on the customer base. We all realize, because of environmental and economic disasters, either looming or here, that the world is very, very interconnected. And so if banks can reach customers answering all their needs and not simplistically looking just to cost or convenience but really what they want in a bank, then that will be good for the banking sector, and it is actually something we're positioned to do. It's a more high-cost approach to marketing. It's a more relationship-based product, but that's essentially where we thought we could add value. So it's easy for me to say that a little bit because we have patient capital, and we probably will even in a growth phase. We can access philanthropic dollars for capital. Squeezed by Wall Street profit expectations, I might be saying something entirely different, but even traditional capital is aware that consumers are complex beings who live in an integrated world.
Well, Steve, this squeeze question, I know we were talking in the green room earlier about your business model is that you manage hotels for private owners, right?
And right.
Now, and you were telling us that this, because of the economic times, that your owners are really feeling the pinch and the squeeze of all this. How is that affecting, is there a dynamic tension here between wanting to really do the right thing and people, maybe outside forces from outside your management facility, your management organization? Are there pressures to compromise? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not pressures, it's demands. Of the 44 hotels and restaurants that we operate, about a third of them we own for ourselves, and the rest we will manage for, an investment group, so to speak. And these investment groups will, buy these buildings, pay for the renovation, refinance them as soon as they possibly can, take their money, do other investments, condos, land, whatever it may be. And the typical investor will try to leverage as high as they possibly can. That's what they do. That's why they're developers. And they might get as much as 90% debt on one of these buildings. Well, the problem is when you run into a time like we're in right now and business is maybe 60 or 70% what it should be and the rates are low and the restaurants aren't doing as great as they used to, the cash flow coming in every day, every month is not what it used to be. And you can only build up just so many reserves, and eventually you run out of reserves, especially if you've been in a recession for a year and a depression for 8 months that has no end in sight. A great example, I'm on the phone today with one of our investor groups. One of the hallmarks of our hotels is that we offer a complimentary wine hour every night in every one of our hotels. You know, one of the big things in our environments is the whole social aspect of kind of interacting with the other guests and allowing the guests to interact with our employees. We believe, as corny as it may sound, we believe in that sense of family and community within our guests as well as with our employees. It's a huge part of why people actually stay at our hotels. Well, that costs a few dollars to do every night, run a wine hour for an hour for 200, 300 people. That adds up at the end of 30 days. So I'm sitting down with an owner that says, we're not going to make the payroll this month, or we can't make the mortgage payment, or whatever it may be. And it's like, so you got to cancel the wine hour. You got to, that soap and shampoo, you got to go find those little bottles that you can get 2 for 1. And on and on and on. It's like, we can't do that. Because our brand stands for what it stands for. I have hotels like the Monaco, the Palomar, the Prescott, the Harbor Court, the Argonaut Hotel. I've got some of the nicest hotels in the country. And the absolute last thing I can afford to do is compromise my brand standards because somebody's over-leveraged financially their financial situation. It's their problem. Me saving a couple of $1,000s by maybe modifying the wine hour isn't going to solve the $100,000 or $1 million problem that these people have from a financial standpoint. But they're my owners. And some of these owners have maybe 4 or 5 hotels with me. So it's huge stress point. And how do we balance out all of those needs, maintain the brand standards for which we're known, which as we get bigger, we get more well-known, and the expectation of our guests to go from one hotel to the other are very demanding as well. And it's a problem. And so, we're working our way through it, and we'll figure it out. But the day-to-day demands, especially right now and especially with the economic outlook, is pretty difficult. I always have to be careful when I say things like this because I never know where this is going to go. We're not selling any hotels, and nobody's going out of business and so on and so forth. But there are huge financial stresses on the part of our financial partners, depending on how they choose to run their financial strategies.
Right. So don't tweet about this just yet. Talk to Steve before you send it out.
I know. I'll get a call at home tonight from somebody. Always happens.
Rajan, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, Steve, I wanted to ask you a quick question, which is that since building, an experiential brand is really part of what all of us do, not only for ourselves, but in our case, others, how do you find competition also faced with, you know, the same economic situations that you've got, where sustainability and conscious capitalism is at the heart of Kempton, do you find that on the margins a differentiator, or is it even bigger than that?
Yeah, I do. What I see in the in a lot of the hotel organizations that we compete against, and that's everything from Mandarin Ritz-Carlton to Hampton Inns, we compete with everybody who's out there, that many of the bigger brands, the more established brands, are willing to cut back and compromise, and they'll try to explain it away to their guests. And, you know, for the most part, the guests understand that. Yet at the end of the day, it's really not – you'd have to understand Kempton. Again, we're our whole thing is all about trying to identify the guests' needs and the guests' what's going to make travel for them the best. You know, our loyalty program, we don't do miles and points. The whole world does miles and points, which is a great reason not to do it. Our whole loyalty thing is about, you know, when you're traveling, what are the things you want to see in the room that'll make you feel comfortable? And it might be music or something to read or something to eat, or the windows are open or whatever it might be. So we've gone down the high road of trying to really satisfy our guests on a one-to-one marketing. That's the brain damage in any industry, and we do it really, really well. There's a cost to doing that. So there's a cost to having a full hotel. And even though I'm more full today than my competitive set, I'm at a lower level than what I need to be to manage the financial need of the asset. So we've kind of dug in and said, this is what we stand for, and this is who we are. And we've spent 28 years building our brand, and yeah, these are really crummy times, but we're not gonna let it go. We can't, or we lose our credibility. We end up starting all over again. That's a problem. So we've never been here before. You know, people used to say this is worse than 9/11. This is not as bad as 9/11. That is so not the case. This is devastating. 9/11 kind of came and went. This is devastating. This is crushing. So whatever stresses and strains I had today, they're going to be a little worse on Monday next week, because it's going that way, although summer's picking up a little bit.
Okay, Don, I'm going to turn to you for a little bit more optimistic outlook on things, because I know you guys are still at capacity at the Academy. One of the questions I had for you, we're talking about different constituencies within a larger ecosystem of an organization, like Steve's talking about and what Rajan was talking about with Open Architecture Network. Now, I was really amazed to find out that the California Academy of Sciences is not just a wonderful combination of museum, planetarium, aquarium, but in fact it's a full-scale research, PhD-level research organization with something like 50 PhD scientists and 200 researchers and expeditions going on all over the world. And on your website, I saw the Science Heroes and some really cool, which the website that Rajan did for you guys and Hot Studio created for you. It was a brilliant website, brilliant, brilliant work that you guys are doing. Now, how does it work for scientists who are looking to be out doing their expeditions and seeing their self as most important, and guests who are coming in wanting maybe a Disneyland kind of approach, and then people from the museum and science side seeing their mission as most important? Is that easy?
I think there's three or four questions there. I'm going to try to actually pull them apart. First, I want to back up. Steve had commented on 9/11. And when that occurred, people didn't travel because they chose not to travel. It was out of fear. In this economy that we're in now, people can't travel. It is a financial issue.
Right.
So there is a huge distinction there,
yeah,
where I had money, I just was afraid to travel, versus I've seen my investments erode and I can't travel now. So it is entirely different. The second point that I'd like to make is, when I came here, I had spent about 7 years at Universal Studios Hollywood, and I had to keep repeating over and over to our board members, I promise you I will not put a roller coaster around the outside of the building. I promise you I will not put a roller coaster around the outside of the building. And I worked very hard to convince them about importing best practices from a major attraction like Universal Studios Hollywood without compromising the mission or the authenticity of what we are from a scientific standpoint. As it relates to the research team, we were very fortunate last July to bring in David Mendel from the University of Michigan, who is our Dean of Research, Dean of Science. And he is, at this point, we have a wonderful research team, and I always say we cover all of the ologies: entomology, ornithology, ichthyology, herpetology, mammalogy, geology. We cover all of the major bodies. One of the things that David is doing right now is he's trying to focus our research plan not so much to look at these independent fields, but to look at what are the large looming questions today that we're trying to answer that's consistent with where do we come from, how do we sustain life as we know it. And he's working on that plan right now. I don't know that there's really a challenge between being a research facility and also being a cultural institution, or more specifically, an attraction. People are coming to see our exhibits. I really think that they can coexist, and that's because there are a variety of resources available to us. Where we may fund some of the research with our operating revenue, we also have the opportunity to go to organizations like the National Science Foundation, who will actually extend grants based on what the different researchers are working on. So I think there's actually a pretty healthy symbiosis between the two functions. I think that if you were to ask our management team, they would say, well, because the percentage of revenue we derive from operations, that's what keeps the engine moving. Where previously in our business model, it was really on the back of our gracious donors. Well, we couldn't sustain ourselves on the back of the donors. We had to start generating operating revenue as well. But to the question of these different research disciplines, they coexist pretty well, and I think that's because they have been doing so for over 100 years.
Oh, that's great. That's good to hear. Well, thank you. Well, unfortunately, we've reached a place in our program now where we only have time for one more question. I have an audience question here. It's kind of a broad one, but let's see if this one will be a good place to end here. To what extent does conscious capitalism compete with nonprofits for the, quote, business of serving socially justified ends? So I guess it means for-profit conscious capitalism. To what extent does conscious capitalism compete with nonprofits for the, quote, business of serving socially justified ends? Is there, in fact, a contest, or is it a purely complementary relationship? So do you guys understand that question? So is there a distinction between a for-profit endeavor that is conscious with a nonprofit endeavor? Is there a competition, or is there a complementarity?
Well, I'd say from our perspective, it's very much synergistic. We are a for-profit firm, and we partner with community organizations, which many of which are nonprofit, and the net result is what the net result is. And you know, if that nonprofit had endeavored to do that totally on their own without having us involved, then maybe they would have gotten to a result. But we think that our involvement made it that much better. So I think it is something that really is complementary.
Steve, what do you think about that?
I agree. I think, you know, if we weren't as successful a company as we are, we wouldn't be able to, you know, donate the monies that we do to the Trust for Public Land for their parks for people. You know, we're helping build parks in urban areas for kids that would never go to a park or go to a rec center. You know, if I couldn't write a little bit of a check for that, it would not happen. Dress for Success, I'm about to underwrite their entire annual convention here in San Francisco. I'm taking rooms out of inventory at a time when my hotels could actually be doing well and selling those rooms to the public. And you know, in every one of our cities come the fall, we have a major red ribbon campaign in every city, and we raise, you know, $200,000. But it's the power behind our businesses and our brand that allows us to go out and host those events and donate those monies. So I think, you know, again, if you've got it and you're inclined, you can give it, or you've got it, you can use it to generate profit. And again, it allows us, because we are for profit and we've got the employee base we do, we get our employees involved, we get our vendors involved, we get everybody we can involved. So it allows us, I think, in my world, to have a pretty strong financial impact in the environments that we're in, the communities that we're in.
Great, thank you. Well, Kat, from your point of view, how does this all come together?
Well, We definitely view them as complementary sectors, and we work a lot with nonprofits. We're very involved with all four major community foundations of the Bay Area and a host of other independent nonprofits. But we're also a little bit different in that we're a regulated entity. For the privilege of taking deposits, which is really a way of leveraging people's money for good ends, we have not just a profit incentive, we have a profit mandate. You know, we're regulated by an entity that would not look kindly on us not making a profit eventually. So we're a little bit different in that respect, but I think